The future is on the line. Democracy hangs in the balance. The stakes couldn't be higher.
You're listening to The Stakes, KPFA's weekly deep dive into the races, issues, and power struggles shaping America's democracy. As the 2026 midterm elections unfold, we go beyond campaign headlines to examine the policies, court battles, voting rights disputes, and grassroots movements driving the national conversation. Stay tuned for The Stakes. You're listening to The Stakes on KPFA, where we look at the upcoming November midterm elections. I'm Teresa Wersbianska. Scott Baba will be back with us next week. Today, we're tracking two major debates, one centered on how much data the government should collect and the other about how much wealth the public should be able to tax. First, a federal judge has blocked the Trump administration from using a newly expanded federal database containing Americans' personal information for voter verification purposes. The court found that federal officials created a centralized system of sensitive personal data in ways Congress did not authorize, and privacy advocates warned it could lead to eligible voters being wrongly flagged or removed entirely from the rolls. Later in the hour, we'll speak with John Davison, Deputy Director and Director of Enforcement at the Electronic Privacy Information Center, one of the groups that brought the lawsuit alongside the League of Women Voters. Then later in the program, we turn to California, where voters are now poised to decide a proposed billionaire tax that would place a one-time levy on the state's wealthiest residents to fund public services like healthcare, education, and anti-poverty programs. We'll be joined by Emmanuel Saez, an economist at UC Berkeley and one of the country's leading researchers on wealth inequality and taxation, to break down what this proposal would do. But first, primaries in Utah, South Carolina's runoff, Maryland, and New York, where Democratic Socialist New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani had a big night with his crew in New York's Democratic primaries. Democratic Socialist-backed candidates pulled off a series of major upsets, including wins over establishment Democrats in several congressional races in New York City. People are saying this could show a leftward shift in the city's Democratic electorate, with some of these insurgent candidates gaining ground in districts long held by the party's traditional leadership. Eileen Alfandari has more on this story.
New York Mayor Zoran Mamdani spoke at the campaign party of Daria Lisa Avila Chevalier, who defeated five-term incumbent Adriana Espaillat to represent Harlem and neighboring communities. Avila Chevalier's upset victory came a year after Mamdani rocked the political establishment by winning his Democratic primary for mayor.
We are showing that last June, a year ago tomorrow, was not an anomaly. It was not the end. It was the beginning.
Appearing on Democracy Now!, Avila Chevalier described herself as the Afro-Latina Dominican daughter of immigrants who has been organizing her entire adult life around immigration justice, ending mass incarceration, and on Palestine.
We centered the needs of this community at the heart of this campaign, where we are fighting for housing for all, to make sure that we abolish ICE and to have our tax dollars come back home to invest in our babies here and not in bombs abroad.
The 32-year-old Avila Chevalier was an organizer of the 2024 Columbia University Palestine Solidarity Encampment protesting Israel's war on Gaza. She came under severe criticism for joining a protest against Israel the day after the October 7th, 2023 attack by Hamas. Avila Chevalier also was the target of racist and Islamophobic attacks, questioning her Dominican heritage and making an issue of her Muslim faith. Espaillat struggled to overcome his support from AIPAC, the American Israel Political Action Committee, and the real estate lobby in one of the poorest congressional districts in the nation. Avila Chevalier narrowly eked out victory over Espaillat, 49-46%. In contrast, former New York City Comptroller Brad Lander scored an overwhelming primary victory, winning nearly two-thirds of the vote over incumbent Dan Goldman to represent a district comprising Lower Manhattan and Brooklyn. Both men are Jewish but held distinct positions on Israel and U.S. support for its longtime ally. Lander addressed the issue, saying in his victory speech that Democrats are painfully divided on the U.S. relationship to Israel and Palestine.
Our party needs to admit that Joe Biden's hug Bibi strategy was a catastrophic failure. I believe it made us complicit in genocide. Bombs we paid for killed over 70,000 Palestinians, mostly women and children. Tanks we sent made over a million people homeless. Humanitarian aid is still not getting in. We cannot keep paying for Netanyahu's wars with our tax dollars. Democratic voters across the country are saying this loud and clear.
Yes. Lander describes himself as a liberal Zionist. He is not a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, but did have Mayor Mamdani's backing. A third candidate backed by both Mamdani and the DSA, Assemblymember Claire Valdez, easily won her primary for an open seat vacated by retiring Democratic Congresswoman Nydia Velazquez. Velazquez had supported another candidate. The victories in New York will add to the growing ranks of congressional Democrats who oppose continued U.S. weapons funding for Israel and who want the Democratic Party to stake out a more confrontational approach to dealing with the remaining years of the Trump presidency. The victories also raise the national profile of New York Mayor Mamdani. In Washington, Congressman Pete Aguilar, who chairs the House Democratic Caucus, turned aside questions about whether the results represented a shift in the Democratic Party, and he indicated he didn't have a particular message for Mamdani.
The mayor of New York doesn't get a vote in the Democratic caucus. The members who are elected get those votes, and we look forward to working with the members that New York elects to serve in the Democratic caucus.
Other lawmakers were more forthright. Senator Bernie Sanders, who had endorsed both Claire Valdez and Brad Lander, but not Daria Lisa Avila Chevalier, said the message from last night's election was clear.
People want change. That was what took place in New York. That's what we're seeing all over this country. Our job is to grow that movement.
Silicon Valley Congressman Ro Khanna, who had also supported Valdez and Lander, tweeted that, quote, "The progressive movement is crushing the establishment in New York City. Some have criticized my supporting progressive insurgents. Tonight shows we have a new party." At a press event, a New York reporter asked Mamdani whether he would get involved in other campaigns.
After the success both you and the candidates you supported saw yesterday, do you plan to throw your weight behind other races in the future?
Mamdani's response:
I made a promise a year ago to New Yorkers that I would use every tool at my disposal to fulfill our affordability agenda, and electing more partners to do so is exactly one of those tools.
I'm Eileen Alfandary for KPFA News.
Maryland voters headed to the polls Tuesday in a primary election that will shape the state's congressional delegation and governor's race ahead of the 2026 midterms. One of the biggest contests was in Maryland's 5th congressional district, where more than 20 Democrats competed to replace retiring Congressman Steny Hoyer after more than four decades in Congress. State Delegate Adrian Boafo emerged as the Democratic nominee, backed by endorsements from Hoyer, Governor Wes Moore, and Senator Angela Alsobrooks. The race attracted millions of dollars in outside spending and was one of the most expensive House primaries in the country. Another major contest took place in Maryland's 6th District, where incumbent Representative April McLean Delaney faced a challenge from former Congressman David Trone. The race drew national attention because both candidates spent heavily and represented competing visions for the Democratic Party. At the top of the ticket, Governor Westmore sought renomination as Democrats look to maintain their dominance in the blue state. Republicans also selected their nominee in a crowded gubernatorial field. Hardliner GOP candidate Dan Cox will rematch with Moore after the Democrat handily defeated Cox in the governor's race 4 years ago. Here is Governor Westmore speaking at a press event on Election Day.
I'm proud of the progress that we've done thus far, but we have more work to do. And that's why I'm asking for another 4 years. You know, we're proud of the fact that we've been able to decrease violent crime by the fastest level in the United States of America. I'm proud of the fact that we've gone from 40th in public education when I first took over to now having public education that is on pace of taking over as the top public education system within the country. I'm proud of the fact that we've gotten the economy going.
Republican gubernatorial nominee Dan Cox also addressed supporters on election night.
What an honor to be once again nominated to do something that we know has to be done, to renew Maryland, to save our beautiful state. We are ready to bring a fresh start in leadership for all of Maryland, for a newness and renewal for our beautiful state and for all our people.
Political observers say Maryland's primaries could offer an early glimpse into voter sentiment heading into November, with several congressional districts expected to remain safely Democratic, making the primary effectively the decisive election. Several key primary and runoff races were also decided Tuesday across Utah and South Carolina. In Utah, voters selected nominees in a series of congressional primaries. One of the most significant outcomes came in the second congressional district, where former Democratic Congressman Ben McAdams secured the party's nomination, positioning himself for a competitive general election. Meanwhile, in South Carolina, the spotlight was on a Republican gubernatorial runoff that served as a major test of the state's GOP direction and the continued influence of President Donald Trump. In that race, South Carolina Attorney General Alan Wilson defeated Lieutenant Governor Pamela Yvette in the runoff for the Republican nomination for governor. Wilson consolidated support from establishment Republicans. Maine's U.S. Senate race is turning into an increasingly sharp debate over abortion rights and the future of health care. Democratic challenger Graham Platner received the endorsement of Planned Parenthood Action Fund Monday. The organization seeks to help Democrats reclaim control of the Senate and expand federal protections for reproductive rights. At a rally in Portland, Platner and Planned Parenthood leaders criticized incumbent Republican Senator Susan Collins for her role to confirm Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, a vote they argued helped pave the way for the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. Platner, a military veteran and progressive Democrat, said reproductive health care should be protected nationwide. And he argued Congress must go beyond restoring the protections that existed before the Dobbs decision.
We need to be clear, it's not enough to just go back to Roe. We need to enshrine those rights in federal law forever and all time to make sure that we are not just one bad judge away from seeing rights stripped away from 26 million Americans.
Platner also linked the abortion debate to larger questions of healthcare access, calling for universal healthcare and expanded federal support for reproductive care. He accused Collins of failing to protect abortion rights despite portraying herself as a moderate Republican.
When Susan Collins told us that Brett Kavanaugh had assured her that Roe was settled law, it was the law of the land, and that a woman's right to choose was in no way, shape, or form under threat, she either lied to us or she was tricked. Neither one of those is something we want out of our United States Senator for the state of Maine.
Responding to recent comments from Collins that the end of Roe has had little effect in Maine because the state has strengthened abortion protections, Plattner said Mainers are concerned not only about their own rights, but the rights of women across the country. Collins rejects criticism that she has failed to deliver for Maine voters, arguing on Fox News that her long record of independence and bipartisan accomplishments makes her the strongest candidate in the race.
I think I need to make sure that the people of Maine understand my record of independence and delivering results. In the end, this comes down to whether you want a candidate who will go to Washington, engage in angry rhetoric every day, but not get anything done versus a service to the people of Maine, where I have delivered real results to the people of Maine.
As the campaign moves towards November, abortion rights are emerging as a defining issue in what is expected to be one of the nation's most closely watched Senate races. This week, a federal judge has blocked the Trump administration from using a newly expanded federal database containing Americans' personal information, ruling that the system violated federal privacy laws and could lead to eligible voters being wrongly removed from voter rolls. The ruling centers on the federal government's overhaul of the Systematic Alien Verification for Entitlements, or SAVE, database. Originally designed to verify immigration status for government benefits, the system was expanded following a Trump executive order aimed at identifying non-citizens on voter rolls. The updated database combined information from multiple federal agencies, including Social Security records and citizenship data, and allowed states to conduct large-scale searches. In a sharply worded opinion, U.S. District Judge Sparkle Suknanen said federal officials had created a centralized repository of sensitive personal information in a manner that Congress has explicitly sought to prevent. The judge found that the administration violated federal privacy protections by pulling data from multiple agencies and then repurposing it for voter verification. Voting rights groups and privacy advocates who brought the lawsuit argued that the database contained inaccurate citizenship information for some Americans and could lead to lawful voters being incorrectly flagged or removed from registration rolls. Court records indicate that at least 67 million voter registrations had been checked through the system. John Davison is deputy director and director of enforcement at the Electronic Privacy Information Center, one of the organizations behind the lawsuit, and I got a chance to chat with him.
Hi, thank you for speaking with me today.
Certainly.
For listeners who are just hearing about the SAVE database, can you explain what it is, how it was originally designed to function, and how and basically what happened this week?
Sure. So the SAVE system was created in the 1980s by Congress for the limited purpose of verifying whether non-citizens are eligible for government benefits. It was built for that purpose. And has been used consistently for that in the intervening decades. Recently, in 2025, the administration took steps to dramatically overhaul and expand SAVE. That included injecting data from the Social Security Administration about citizenship and immigration status into the system. It included allowing states to use it for bulk voter roll verification, that is checking their voter roll against the SAVE system to assertedly identify potential non-citizens who are registered voters. And it did so in violation of a law called the Privacy Act, which prohibits the disclosure of personal information by a federal agency outside of some fairly narrow conditions that weren't met here. And that's what the court decided yesterday, among other things, that the Social Security Administration and Department of Homeland Security had not taken the steps required to transfer and connect that information, had engaged in unlawful expansion and misuse of the SAVE database, and had done so in a way that trampled on the voting rights of many people who were wrongly removed from voter rolls as a result of the system being sort of ham-fistedly expanded.
And your organization, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, raised concerns about privacy and legality in the way this database was going to be used for voter eligibility checks. What made your organization initially concerned about that?
Well, there's several things. First of all, the right to vote is a fundamental right, and it deserves the greatest protection. So establishing an expanded SAVE system that, because of widespread inaccuracies in the data, threatened to result in many people losing their fundamental right to vote for no reason, is a grave threat to, you know, a constitutionally protected right that we all, I think, cherish. But it also, of course, raises significant privacy issues. You know, our federal laws, and especially the Privacy Act, require agencies to carefully safeguard the personal information that they collect and maintain about us. They cannot share it freely between agencies. They cannot use it for just any old purpose. They have to adhere to strict safeguards of the Privacy Act. And that wasn't done here. And this was really turning a system that had a particular purpose, you know, set out 40 years ago, into one that was a freewheeling system for states to use for notoriously inaccurate citizenship verification checks on a bulk scale and outside of what the law permits. So it was concerning to EPIC, both because of the privacy implications, but also because of the threat that it posed to voting rights generally.
And I'd like to turn to the court ruling. The court ruling in this case found that the federal government violated privacy protections. What do you think are the implications of that decision for how federal agencies can handle large-scale personal data systems?
I think they're potentially quite significant. You know, the court really underscored that the provision of the Privacy Act that in some cases allows disclosure from one agency to another, it is not an open-ended authority. You know, there are conditions that have to be met for that transfer to be legal, and they weren't met here. You know, this data, these records at the Social Security Administration that in many cases indicate citizenship or immigration status, were not fit for the purpose of creating a nationwide citizenship lookup tool for states to use in the voting context. And that's a really important assertion and conclusion by the court, because it says that agencies, and by the way, this has been the law for decades, but it underscores that agencies can't make up a pretextual reason to disclose information to another agency or rely on a flimsy, incompatible explanation for how the data might be used. So it really is, I would say, putting meat on the bones of a law that protects our personal information in the hands of federal agencies.
Looking ahead, what kinds of safeguards or policy changes would EPIC want to see come into being to prevent voter data systems from being used in ways that could risk disenfranchising people?
Sure. I think the biggest and most immediate example would be for the federal government to stop trying to inject itself in the determination of voter eligibility where it does not have a legal role. That's behind all of what we've seen in the way of voter data collection and the creation of citizenship lists and the expansion of the SAVE database. This is the administration trying to step in and seize from the states their role in maintaining voter rolls. And they're doing so with a political agenda. So I think suspending that campaign is the most immediate one. And this, you know, vacating the SAVE database, as the court did yesterday, is an enormous stride towards that. But there's you know, potentially much more that needs to be done in that regard. And I think also, you know, taking voter privacy seriously. Many states do. This administration does not. But I think understanding that we should be looking for ways to reinforce the right to vote and not to burden it by turning people's personal information against them is really key to sort of digging out of this swamp of voter disenfranchisement that we see the current administration creating.
Well, thanks for chatting with me today, John.
Certainly happy to talk.
That was John Davison from the Electronic Privacy Information Center, one of the organizations behind the lawsuit, which also included the League of Women Voters. The Trump administration has defended the program as a necessary tool to help states maintain accurate voter rolls and prevent non-citizen voting. The Justice Department is expected to appeal. The ruling is the latest legal setback for the administration's efforts to expand the federal government's role in election administration and voter verification. But, Justin, yesterday, Wednesday, a federal judge has permanently blocked most of President Trump's executive order that would have required documentary proof of citizenship to register to vote, ruling that the president does not have constitutional authority to impose election rules that belong to Congress and the states. The decision, issued Wednesday, turns an earlier injunction into a permanent ban on key provisions of the order, including the citizenship requirement and related restrictions on mail voting and federal funding penalties for states that did not comply. This ruling comes as part of ongoing legal challenges from Democratic state attorneys general who argue the policy would have risked disenfranchising eligible voters and exceeded executive power. And we're going to take a deeper look at that story next time. You're listening to The Stakes on KPFA. I'm Teresa Wersbianska with Scott Baba. California voters are on track to decide one of the most closely watched tax proposals in the country in November, a so-called billionaire tax that would impose a levy on the state's wealthiest residents to fund public services, including healthcare, education, and anti-poverty programs. The measure, backed by the Service Employees International Union, United Healthcare Workers West, has officially qualified for the 2026 ballot this past week after organizers say they collected more than 1.5 million signatures, clearing the threshold required for certification. Suzanne Jimenez, chief of staff for the SEIU-UHW, told KCRA News that this proposal would generate much-needed revenue for California programs.
So the California billionaire tax is a one-time emergency 5% tax that is taxed on only 200 or just over 200 individuals here in California, and it would raise about $100 billion over 5 years. 90% of it would go to healthcare, 10% of it would go to K through 14 education and food assistance programs.
At its core, the proposal would tax Californians with wealth above $1 billion. Supporters say it could raise tens of billions of dollars over several years, helping to offset budget shortfalls and stabilize social services that have come under pressure from rising costs and shifting federal support. But even as the measure clears the ballot hurdle, its future is now uncertain. According to recent reporting, the union behind the initiative has opened the door to major changes, offering to reduce the proposed tax rate from 5% to 2% if Governor Gavin Newsom agrees to support a negotiated legislative deal instead of sending the measure to voters. Newsom, however, has so far resisted the proposal, warning that taxing extreme wealth could prompt high net worth residents to leave California, shrinking the state's long-term tax base and ultimately undermining funding for the very services supporters want to protect. The political battle has quickly exposed divisions inside California's Democratic coalition. Labor leaders argue the tax is a direct response to widening inequality and growing demand for public services, especially in housing, healthcare, and education. Jimenez, chief of staff of the SEIU UHW, says that history shows these kinds of one-time wealth taxes are successful at raising income for public services.
You know, there are always these kind of Chicken Little arguments whenever there are tax policies like this being proposed. And when we look at real life examples of these kind of tax policies, none of that ever materializes. So as an example, in Massachusetts, they moved a millionaire's tax. And there were lots of kind of rumors and speculations that millionaires were going to flee the state. And when the tax passed, it actually was the opposite. And so now there are more millionaires in the state of Massachusetts. And so I just think kind of the swirl that is happening right now around the California billionaire tax is kind of the same argument. And we really believe that the benefit from this tax is going to outweigh, you know, maybe a couple people moving out of the state, because we're really heading towards a healthcare crisis where we are going to see billions of dollars cut from our healthcare system. And the money raised in this initiative is going to support that.
But opponents, including business groups and influential tech donors, say the measure risks destabilizing the state's economy. They argue that wealthy residents and investors could relocate, just take off, taking jobs and tax revenue with them. Thanks to Google co-founder Sergey Brin, who has supported efforts to block or reshape the initiative. Critics also argue the proposal could face legal and logistical challenges, particularly around how extreme wealth could be assessed and taxed. Here's California Governor Gavin Newsom speaking at a recent press event, saying he opposes the billionaire tax proposal.
It's a badly drafted effort. It's already had an outsized impact on this state. It does not support our public educators, does not support our teachers and counselors, our librarians. It doesn't support our first responders and firefighters. It doesn't support the general fund.
But behind the scenes, negotiations are intensifying. With a key certification deadline approaching, there is now a possibility the measure could still be withdrawn if a compromise is reached between labor leaders and the governor, turning what was expected to be a ballot fight into a negotiated policy deal. The proposal is expected to be decided by voters in November, unless something changes before final certification or litigation intervenes. Joining us now to help make sense of this tax proposal's journey is Emmanuel Saez, an economist at the University of California, Berkeley, and one of the world's leading researchers on income and wealth inequality. He is the director of the Center for Equitable Growth at UC Berkeley and has co-authored influential works on taxation and the concentration of wealth, including research that has helped shape debates over progressive tax policy in the United States and abroad. Welcome, Emmanuel.
Thank you, Teresa. Delighted to be here.
All right. So this billionaire tax proposal would impose a one-time tax on Californians with wealth over $1 billion. What problem is this policy trying to solve? And do you think a wealth-based tax is the right tool?
So the Trump administration last summer passed a big tax cut. And to fund partly that tax cut, they cut, you know, $1 trillion of the Medicaid program over the next 10 years that serves low and middle income Americans. The loss in funding for California Medicaid program, Medi-Cal, is going to be about $100 billion over the next 5 years. If those cuts go through, a lot of folks are going to lose their health insurance. The program currently covers, you know, 30% of Californians. And therefore, California will experience a surge in the fraction of population uninsured. We went down, you know, from 18% uninsured before Obamacare down to 6%. So it's a really good number. With those cuts, the number is going to shoot up again, perhaps around 10%. So the state, if we want to avoid those consequences, needs to replace the lost revenue from the federal government. And it's a substantial amount of revenue. It's hard actually for the legislature and the governor to do that by themselves. And so in recent years, this has traditionally done, you know, through a ballot initiative. And that's how the billionaire tax came to be. So why do we target billionaires? Basically because their wealth has surged enormously, so that today there's a lot of wealth there in the billionaire class, and just a 5% tax on them can bring about $100 billion of revenue, plugging in the hole in federal defunding for the next 5 years. And the billionaire class also turns out to be the group that is currently the least taxed, because the current tax system doesn't do well at taxing, you know, the true economic income and wealth gains of the billionaire tax. So the tax that way also restores progressivity and tax justice all the way to the top.
All right. Supporters argue that this billionaire tax could raise the tens of billion dollars for healthcare, like you just mentioned, and education and some of the anti-poverty programs that we're seeing here in the state. What assumptions are those revenue estimates based on? And do you think they're right?
Yes. So the revenue estimate that we estimate at $100 billion is a very simple computation. The Forbes magazine maintains a daily list of billionaires in the world, and then in particular in California. Currently, it lists 250 California billionaires with a total wealth of about $2.3 trillion. So 10% of that is more than $100 billion. You can factor in some tax avoidance, and that's how we get to the number of $100 billion. What I want to emphasize is that the tax is based on billionaires, is going to affect billionaires who were resident in California as of the beginning of the year, January 1st, 2026. And that means that it's extremely hard to avoid the tax by leaving the state, because when the initiative was announced in November, it left only a very short 1 month window to leave the state to avoid the tax. And that's something that we believe is extremely hard, perhaps even impossible for billionaires to do, because they have such deep ties to the state.
Yeah, and the billionaires don't love this proposal, obviously, and some of the opponents, like Gavin Newsom's, like, it's not good. The billionaires are going to leave the state. What's your response to that and the capital flight argument against it?
So my response is that we've precisely designed the tax so that it's hard, if not impossible, to leave. So billionaires have been making noise. Obviously, they are not happy about the fact that for the first time, they are going to be asked, you know, to pay a substantial tax, you know, commensurate with the enormous gains they've been making. So a number of them have made noise, threatened to leave. But the reality is that if you couldn't leave by January 1st, it's too late. You are going to have to pay the tax anyway. Second, even if a billionaire leaves, that doesn't mean that the business leaves California. That is, billionaires who are retired, they've already founded their company, they are no longer involved day-to-day in the management of the business, may leave California, not to avoid this tax, but perhaps to avoid, you know, future taxes, yet nothing substantial would happen, you know, to the business they founded.
The organizations behind this proposal, which include some labor groups, some progressive groups, I'm wondering if you can explain, they have offered to reduce the proposed tax rate from 5% to 2% if Governor Newsom agrees to support a negotiated legislative deal instead of sending this measure to voters. Can you say anything about that?
Yes. So whenever there is a ballot initiative, there are negotiations to see if we can come to an agreement between, you know, the proponents and the government. And so the union was willing, you know, to reduce substantially the tax from 5% to 2%. So that it would solve the funding problem for 2 years instead of 5 years. But you saw the response we got very quickly from the governor, and that has been consistent through those negotiations that have been going on for a while. The governor was extremely clear. He said, no tax targeting specifically billionaires. I don't want to hear about any tax that would specifically target billionaires. The legislature and the governor have proposed some small taxes, you know, on the software purchases, increasing taxes on health premium for private insurance, but they really don't want to hear about billionaires taxation. Again, my view is that that's the influence, you know, on billionaires, on elected officials, and that's why we need a direct vote of the people.
And Elon Musk doesn't live in California, huh?
Not anymore.
Not anymore. Well, that's all the questions I have, Emmanuel. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Emmanuel Saez, an economist at the University of California, Berkeley, and one of the world's leading researchers on income and wealth inequality. Coming up next, we turn to our regular media literacy segment from Project Censored, the longtime media watchdog group focused on underreported stories, corporate media influence, and critical news analysis. Here are Mickey Huff and Eleanor Goldfield from Project Censored.
Hi, I'm Mickey Huff with Eleanor Goldfield from the Project Censored show, and this is our recurring critical media literacy moment for The Stakes, where Eleanor and I talk about things happening around us and current events, and we talk about them through the lens of critical media literacy. And I know this show in particular is sort of looking with an eye toward what's happening at the midterm elections. And of course, Eleanor, we couldn't really talk about any of these things without noticing on the backdrop, or is it the forefront of all of it? It is America at 250. Right. And we've been seeing the beginnings of many celebrations taking place. And certainly the Trump White House has been leading the charge with major events, spectacles, as they were. And it's going to give us an opportunity here to riff on sort of the media spectacle around USA at 250 and Trump's efforts to really kind of lay claim to one definition of patriotism that's jingoistic, that's misogynistic, that's patriarchal. There's actually a lot of truth to that. is that we do have a rather patriarchal, misogynistic, and jingoistic history. The difference is that not everybody seems to celebrate it. And so, Eleanor, recently on the White House lawn, we saw the spectacle of USC extreme fighting. We saw jet flyovers. We saw, you know, half-naked guys rolling around with each other in a ring, beating each other up for Pride Month. We saw the strange turning of green of the Lincoln Memorial reflecting pool. So many things to comment on. So putting on our critical media literacy hats, what are some things we can unpack here about the great spectacle of America at 250?
Well, I mean, we only have 5 minutes, Mickey, and this could be a multi-hour. But I think you really hit the nail on the head there. This is bread and circus, and it's meant as a distraction. And it's a great moment for critical media literacy to say, okay, but what am I being distracted from? Like, I don't know, maybe Trump's total failure in the war in Iran. Like, I mean, there's a long list of things that have gone really wrong. But that, I mean, that also speaks to the history of the United States. And then we see how these things are then used in political ad campaigns. You know, the same sandbox TIFF stuff, like, oh, well, my opponent, and then before you know it, no one's actually talked about policies. They've just been slinging feces at each other, and you leave the thing going, but I don't, what are we actually, like, how is that going to help me get healthcare? This is part of that spectacle, and how the media covers it is also part of that spectacle. Like, oh, did you hear what he said about Hillary Clinton? Like, but that doesn't, that still not is helping anybody get healthcare. And I know, Mickey, you had a really powerful quote and very apt quote that you wanted to share by Guy Debord about specifically this kind of spectacle.
Yeah. And, you know, the spectacle and distraction, they go hand in hand. Debord wrote in the Society of Spectacle that the first stage of the economy's domination of social life brought about an evident degradation of being into having. Human fulfillment was no longer equated with what one was, but with what one possessed, right? And that really gets into another thing that Debord talked about when he mentioned the spectacle, was the spectacle is capital accumulated to the point to where it becomes image, surface, skimming. The whole world of social media is about, it's actually anti-social media. It's about skimming the surface and not going into depth or detail. By the way, when Debord is talking about the image, historian Daniel Boorstin in 1962 wrote a book called The Image, A Guide to Pseudo-Events in America, right? About how we manufacture events and demand that we be distracted. You know, and the whole spectacle of the White House lawn with flipping motorcycles, you know, and all the rest of the things happening. I mean, there's a ridiculousness of it that you know, reminds me of going back to the Doge days when Elon Musk was wielding a chainsaw like President Camacho from the film Idiocracy, which was a satire, not a documentary. And that's really what we're seeing in real life. You and I talk about this on the show. We just talked a little bit about the film Idiocracy and how it wasn't supposed to be sort of a blow-by-blow of where we are at the United States at 250 years old. But that's really kind of what's happening. And if you take a look back at people like Boorstin, like Debord, and the image and the spectacle, it really does sort of foreshadow a world where we need critical media literacy to understand how screens have actually become the bars and cages of our lives and our minds, right? The cage match isn't just on the White House lawn, it's around our skulls, right? And we really need critical media literacy to unpack this. We need to be asking empirical questions. We need to be challenging the things that we see around us, and especially the things that the media just make it that we can't avoid, right? We can't avoid some of the idiotic stories and things that are happening around us as they're slammed onto us day by day. While, as you said, the corporate media ritually ignore key international stories, key domestic stories, you know, from healthcare to, hey, what's actually at stake in the coming midterm elections? Is it just the battle of personalities and sex scandals? Or is it actually a battle for the future of the country and the rights of people that are being trampled and trampled ritually with some celebration, as we see on the White House lawn, right? So I think these are important things to remember moving forward. And as you said, Eleanor, we only have 5 or 6 minutes and we could be unpacking this for hours. So we'll have to leave it at that for today with our friends at the stakes. But Eleanor, anything else you want to add to today's segment?
Yeah, Mickey, I just wanted to add this really quick quote from a friend of mine who does a lot of anti-fascist organizing. And I think it's very perfect, not just for the US at 250, but for the midterms and for any place where your patriotism, whether you have some or not, but whether patriotism and whether care for home place and the people that you consider your neighbors in your community is weaponized for purposes that do not actually give back to those communities and home places. And my friend said that question anything that demands your obedience obedience without your humanity. And so for this week on The Stakes, Mickey Huff and myself, Eleanor Goldfield, that's been your little PSA, your little quick critical media literacy bit. And there's more of that at projectcensored.org. See you next time.
And we want to thank everybody for tuning in to The Stakes.
Those were the voices of Mickey Huff and Eleanor Goldfield from Project Censored.
Please leave a message after the tone.
Here on The Stakes, we want to hear from you. What are your thoughts as we get closer to Election Day in November about issues, candidates, what's in the news? Leave us a 1 minute or shorter voicemail and we might put it on the air. The number to call to leave us a voicemail is 510-848-6767, extension 785. Leave us a voicemail. Tell us what's on your mind and you might get on The Stakes next time.
That's it for the show. The Stakes airs Thursdays at 10 a.m. Check for information about topics and guests online at kpfa.org. For comments and ideas, connect with us at news@kpfa.org. A big thanks to the team, Lauren Schmidt, Jose Gonzalez, our engineers, Kirsten Thomas. I'm your host, Teresa Wierzbianska, with Scott Baba. See you next week on The Stakes.